Maize Lion.
Jim remembers it as a bobcat, and he was May's nephew, and ought to know. It probably was a bobcat. I don't think May would have changed her story, though you can't trust a good storyteller not to make the story suit herself, or get the facts to fit the story better. Anyhow, she told it to us more than once, because my mother and I would ask for it, and the way I remember it, it was a mountain lion. And the way I remember May telling it is sitting on the edge of the irrigation tank we used to swim in, cement, rough as a lava flow and hot in the sun, the long cracks tarred over. She was an old lady then, with a long Irish upper lip, kind and wary and balky. She liked to come sit and talk with my mother while I swam. She didn't have all that many people to talk to. She always had chickens in the chicken house, very near the back door of the farmhouse, so the whole place smelled pretty strong of chickens, and as long as she could, she kept a cow or two down in the old barn by the creek. The first of May's cows, I remember, was Pearl, a big, handsome Holstein, who gave 14 or 24 or 40 gallons or quarts of milk at a milking, whichever is right for a prize milker. Pearl was beautiful in my eyes when I was 4 or 5 years old. I loved and admired her. I remember how excited I was, how I reached upward to them, when Pearl or the workhorse Prince, for whom my love amounted to worship, would put an immense and sensitive muzzle through the three-strand fence to whisk a corn husk from my fearful hand. And then the munching and the sweet breath and the big nose would be at the barbed wire again. The offering is acceptable. After Pearl, there was Rosie, a purebred Jersey. May got her either cheap or free because she was a runt calf, so tiny that May brought her home on her lap in the back of the car like a fawn. And Rosie always looked like she had some deer in her. She was a lovely, clever little cow, and even more willful than old May. She often chose not to come in to be milked. We would hear May calling, and then see her trudging across our lower pasture with the bucket, going to find Rosie, wherever Rosie had decided to be milked today, on the wild hills she had to roam in, 100 acres of our and old Jim's land. Then May had a fox terrier named Pinky, who yipped and nipped and turned me against fox terriers for life. But he was long gone when the mountain lion came, and the black cats who lived in the barn kept discreetly out of the story. As a matter of fact, now I think of it, the chickens weren't in it either. It might have been quite different if they had been. May had quit keeping chickens after old Mrs. Walter died. It was just her, all alone there, and Rosie, and the cats down in the barn, and nobody else within sight or sound of the old farm. We were in our house, up the hill, only in the summer, and Jim lived in town those years. What time of year it was, I don't know, but I imagine the grass still green, or just turning gold, and May was in the house, in the kitchen, where she lived entirely, unless she was asleep or outdoors, when she heard this noise. Now, you need May herself, sitting skinny on the edge of the irrigation tank, 70 or 80 or 90 years old. Nobody knew how old May was, and she had made sure they couldn't find out, opening her pleated lips and letting out this noise, a huge, awful yowl, starting soft with a nasal hum and rising slowly into a snarling gargle that sank away into a sobbing purr. It got better every time she told the story. "It was some meow," she said. So she went to the kitchen door, opened it, and looked out. Then she shut the kitchen door and went to the kitchen window to look out, because there was a mountain lion under the fig tree. Puma, cougar, catamount, Felis concolor, the shy, secret, shadowy lion of the New World, 4 or 5 feet long, plus a yard of black-tipped tail, weighs about what a woman weighs, lives where the deer live from Canada to Chile. But always shyer, always fewer, the color of dry leaves, dry grass. There were plenty of deer in the valley in the '40s, but no mountain lion had been seen for decades anywhere near where people lived. maybe way back up in the canyons, but Jim, who hunted and knew every deer trail in the hills, had never seen a lion. Nobody had, except May, now, alone in her kitchen. "I thought maybe it was sick," she told us. "It wasn't acting right. I don't think a lion would walk right into the yard like that if it was feeling well. If I'd still had the chickens, it'd be a different story, maybe. But it just walked around some, and then it lay down there." And she points between the fig tree and the decrepit garage. "And then after a while, it kind of meowed again and got up and come into the shade right there." The fig tree, planted when the house was built, about the time May was born, makes a great, green, sweet-smelling shade. "It just laid there looking around. It wasn't well," says May. She had lived with and looked after animals all her life. She had also earned her living for years as a nurse. "Well, I didn't know exactly what to do for it, so I put out some water for it. It didn't even get up when I come out the door. I put the water down there, not so close to it that we'd scare each other, see? And it kept watching me, but it didn't move. After I went back in, it did get up and tried to drink some water. Then it made that kind of meow, wow, wow. I do believe it come here because it was looking for help. Or just for company, maybe." The afternoon went on, May in the kitchen, the lion under the fig tree. But down in the barnyard by the creek was Rosie the cow. Fortunately, the gate was shut, so she could not come wandering up to the house and meet the lion. But she would be needing to be milked come 6 or 7 o'clock, and that got to worrying May. She also worried how long a sick mountain lion might hang around, keeping her shut in the house. May didn't like being shut in. "I went out a time or two and went, shoo!" Eyes shining amidst fine wrinkles, she flaps her thin arms at the lion. "Shoo! Go on home now!" But the silent wild creature watches her with yellow eyes and does not stir. "So when I was talking to Miss Macy on the telephone, she said it might have rabies, and I ought to call the sheriff. I was uneasy then, so finally I did that, and they come out, those county police, you know, 2 carloads. Her voice is dry and quiet. I guess there was nothing else they knew how to do, so they shot it. She looks off across the field. Old Jim, her brother, used to plow with Prince the horse and irrigate with the water from this tank. Now wild oats and blackberry grow there. In another 30 years, it will be a rich man's vineyard, a tax write-off. He was 7 feet long, all stretched out, before they took him off, and so thin. They all said, 'Well, Aunt May, I guess you were scared there. I guess you were some scared.' But I wasn't. I didn't want him shot, but I didn't know what to do for him, and I did need to get to Rosie." I have told this true story, which May gave to us, as truly as I could, and now I want to tell it as fiction, yet without taking it from her, rather to give it back to her, if I can do so. It is a tiny part of the history of the valley, and I want to make it part of the valley outside history. Now the field that the poor man plowed and the rich man harvested lies on the edge of a little town. Houses and workshops of timber and fieldstone, standing among almond, oak, and eucalyptus trees. And now May is an old woman with a name that means the month of May, Rain's End. An old woman with a long, wrinkled, pleated upper lip. She is living alone for the summer in her summer place, a meadow a mile or so up in the hills, above the little town Sinchin. She took her cow Rose with her, and since Rose tends to wander, she keeps her on a long tether down by the tiny creek and moves her into fresh grass now and then. The summer house is what they call a 9-pole house, a mere frame of poles stuck in the ground. One of them is a live digger pine sapling with stick and matting walls and mat roof and floors. It doesn't rain in the dry season, and the roof is just for shade. But the house and its little front yard, where Rain's End has her camp stove and clay oven and matting loom, are well shaded by a fig tree that was planted there 100 years or so ago by her grandmother. Rain's End herself has no grandchildren. She never bore a child, and her one or two marriages were brief and very long ago. She has a nephew and two grandnieces, and feels herself an aunt to all children, even when they are afraid of her and rude to her, because she has got so ugly with old age, smelling as musty as a chicken house. She considers it natural for children to shrink away from somebody partway dead, and knows that when they're a little older and have got used to her, they'll ask her for stories. She was for 60 years a member of the doctor's lodge, and though she doesn't do curing any more, people still ask her to help with nursing sick children, and the children come to long for the kind, authoritative touch of her hands when she bathes them to bring a fever down, or changes a dressing, or combs out bed-tangled hair with witch hazel and great patience. So Rain's End was just waking up from an early afternoon nap in the heat of the day, under the matting roof, when she heard a noise, a huge, awful yowl that started soft with a nasal hum and rose slowly into a snarling gargle that sank away into a sobbing purr. And she got up and looked out from the open side of the house of sticks and matting, and saw a mountain lion under the fig tree. She'd looked at him from her house. He'd looked at her from his. And this part of the story is much the same. The old woman, the lion, and down by the creek, the cow. It was hot. Crickets sang shrill in the yellow grass on all the hills and canyons in all the chaparral. Rain's End filled a bowl with water from an unglazed jug and came slowly out of the house. Halfway between the house and the lion, she set the bowl down on the dirt. She turned and went back to the house. The lion got up after a while and came and sniffed at the water. He lay down again with a soft, querulous groan, almost like a sick child, and looked at Rain's End with the yellow eyes that saw her in a different way than she had ever been seen before. She sat on the matting in the shade of the open part of her house and did some mending. When she looked up at the lion, she sang, under her breath, tunelessly. She wanted to remember the Puma dance song, but could only remember bits of it, so she made a song for the occasion. You are there, lion. You are there, lion. As the afternoon wore on, she began to worry about going down to milk Rose. Unmilked, the cow would start tugging at her tether and making a commotion. That was likely to upset the lion. He lay so close to the house now that if she came out, that too might upset him, and she did not want to frighten him or to become frightened of him. He had evidently come for some reason, and it behoved her to find out what the reason was. Probably he was sick. His coming so close to a human person was strange, and people who behave strangely are usually sick or in some kind of pain. Sometimes, though, they are spiritually moved to act strangely. The lion might be a messenger, or might have some message of his own for her or her townspeople. She was more used to seeing birds as messengers. The four-footed people go about their own business. But the lion, dweller in the seventh house, comes from the place dreams come from. Maybe she did not understand. Maybe someone else would understand. She could go over and tell Valiant and her family, whose summer house was in the Gehea Meadow, farther up the creek. Or she could go over to Buck's on Baldy Knoll. But there were four or five adolescents there, and one of them might come and shoot the lion, to boast that he'd saved old Rain's End from getting clawed to bits and eaten. Moo, said Rose, down by the creek reproachfully. The sun was still above the southwest ridge, but the branches of pines were across it, and the heavy heat was out of it, and shadows were welling up in the low fields of wild oats and blackberry. Moo, said Rose again, louder. The lion lifted up his square, heavy head, the color of dry wild oats, and gazed down across the pastures. Rain's End knew from that weary movement that he was very ill. He had come for company in dying. That was all. I'll come back, lion, Rain's End sang tunelessly. Lie still. Be quiet. I'll come back soon. Moving softly and easily, as she would move in a room with a sick child, She got her milking pail and stool, slung the stool on her back with a woven strap so as to leave a hand free, and came out of the house. The lion watched her at first very tense, the yellow eyes firing up for a moment, but then put his head down again with that little grudging, groaning sound. "I'll come back, lion," Rain's End said. She went down to the creek side and milked a nervous and indignant cow. Rose could smell lion and demanded, in several ways, all eloquent, just what Rain's End intended to do. Rain's End ignored her questions and sang milking songs to her. "Sue Bonnie, be still, my grand cow." Once she had to slap her hard on the hip. "Quit that, you old fool. Get over. I am not going to untie you and have you walking into trouble. I won't let him come down this way." She did not say how she planned to stop him. She retethered Rose where she could stand, down in the creek if she liked. When she came back up the rise with the pail of milk in hand, the lion had not moved. The sun was down, the air above the ridges turning clear gold. The yellow eyes watched her, no light in them. She came to pour milk into the lion's bowl. As she did so, he all at once half rose up. Rain's End started and spilled some of the milk she was pouring. "Shoo, stop that," she whispered fiercely, waving her skinny arm at the lion. "Lie down now. I'm afraid of you when you get up. Can't you see that, stupid? Lie down now, lion. There you are. Here I am. It's all right. You know what you're doing." Talking softly as she went, she returned to her house of stick and matting. There she sat down as before, in the open porch, on the grass mats. The mountain lion made the grumbling sound, ending with a long sigh, and let his head sink back down on his paws. Rain's End got some cornbread and a tomato from the pantry box while there was still daylight left to see by, and ate slowly and neatly. She did not offer the lion food. He had not touched the milk, and she thought he would eat no more in the house of earth. From time to time, as the quiet evening darkened and stars gathered thicker overhead, she sang to the lion. She sang the five songs of Going Westward to the Sunrise, which are sung to human beings dying. She did not know if it was proper and appropriate to sing these songs to a dying mountain lion, but she did not know his songs. Twice he also sang, once a quavering moan, like a house cat challenging another tom to battle, and once a long, sighing purr. Before the scorpion had swung clear of Cinchin Mountain, Rain's End had pulled her heavy shawl around herself in case the fog came in, and had gone sound asleep in the porch of her house. She woke with the gray light before sunrise. The lion was a motionless shadow, a little farther from the trunk of the fig tree than he had been the night before. As the light grew, she saw that he had stretched himself out full length. She knew he had finished his dying, and sang the fifth song, the last song, in a whisper, for him. The doors of the four houses are open. Surely they are open. Near sunrise, she went to milk Rose and to wash in the creek. When she came back up to the house, she went closer to the lion, though not so close as to crowd him, and stood for a long time looking at him, stretched out in the long, tawny, delicate light. "As thin as I am," she said to Valiant. When she went up to Gehea later in the morning to tell the story and to ask help, carrying the body of the lion off where the buzzards and coyotes could clean it. "It's still your story, Aunt May. It was your lion. He came to you. He brought his death to you, a gift. But the men with the guns won't take gifts. They think they own death already. And so they took from you the honor he did you, and you felt that loss. I wanted to restore it. But you don't need it. You followed the lion where he went years ago now."